Iran warns that the upcoming Vienna negotiations will fail if the U.S. refuses to scrap all anti-Tehran sanctions first. Thousands of Sudanese rally in several cities against a deal between the military and the government after last month's coup. And COVID cases and deaths are on the rise across Europe as the continent again becomes the epicenter of the pandemic. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran warns the upcoming Vienna talks will fail unless the U.S. agrees to scrap all anti-Tehran sanctions first. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri-Kani stressed that any progress in talks depends on the sanctions removal and a guarantee that a future U.S. administration would not abandon the deal again. Iranian official made the comments during an interview with the British Daily Independent. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are set to start a new round of talks in the Austrian capital on November 29th. Negotiations are aimed at removing anti-Tehran measures. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the UN Security Council, endorsed a nuclear deal in 2018, and reimposed sanctions on Tehran.
Iran's representative at the International Atomic Energy Agency addresses a virtual session of the IAEA's Board of Governors. Mohammad Reza Ghaibi says the Islamic Republic's first priority at the upcoming talks to revive the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, will be the effective and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions without any further delay and any preconditions.
The principal position of the new government of the Islamic Republic of Iran is that the first priority and issue that should be considered seriously into consideration is removal of all illegal sanctions imposed against Iran after the withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal.
Ghaibi said the U.S. needs to address concerns arising from its 2018 withdrawal from the agreement, the least of which is how its possible future adherence can be relied upon. Iran has also criticized European states for requesting that Tehran implement its commitments under the deal, saying that until sanctions are not removed, it's not reasonable to expect more forbearance from the country. During the previous rounds of talks on reviving the JCPOA, Iran made it clear it wanted all U.S. sanctions, including additional ones imposed under the previous administration of Donald Trump, to be removed. Up until now, Tehran says, the administration of Joe Biden has not only failed to mitigate the U.S. maximum pressure policy, but has actually exacerbated it. Delegates from Iran, the three European states of Britain, France, Germany, plus Russia and China, are expected to resume negotiations on Monday here at Vienna's Hotel Coburg, the same venue where talks to reach the nuclear agreement concluded more than 6 years ago. Homar Ezgi, Vienna.
Moving on, the United States has threatened to confront Iran at the International Atomic Energy Agency, accusing Tehran of not cooperating with the UN nuclear watchdog. A U.S. statement came during a meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors. It said, quote, if Iran's non-cooperation is not remedied immediately, the board will have no choice but to reconvene an extraordinary session to address the crisis. It added that such a meeting could take place by the end of the year. Washington said it was referring especially to the reinstalling surveillance cameras at the Karaj site near Tehran, where the IAEA has no access for several months. The facility came under a sabotage attack in June, which Iran blames on Israel. Tehran says the site is under security investigation and therefore off limits to inspection. So 6 months after Israel's all-out war on the besieged Gaza Strip, rights groups say they are deeply concerned over the lack of reconstruction in the enclave. They also raise concern about the ongoing humanitarian situation in Gaza. The tiny enclave is in crisis, and people there are paying the price of the international community's inaction. Ashraf Shannon reports.
The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, along with UNRWA and the Palestinian Ministry of Public Works, held a workshop in the Gaza Strip to discuss Israel's latest destruction of hundreds of buildings during the May War. According to the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, over 100,000 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, sought shelter and protection at UNRWA schools or with hosting families. Currently, there are still about 8,000 Palestinian IDPs, primarily those whose houses were completely destroyed or severely damaged during the one-ton Israeli bombardment.
The Israeli war in May caused massive destruction, especially to residential areas, and thousands of families have been internally displaced. The delay of reconstruction is a direct result of the Israeli blockade. Israel bans the entry of building supplies into the Gaza Strip in a direct and grave violation of the international law and the Fourth Geneva Convention.
People and businesses in the Gaza Strip are still waiting for the reconstruction to start. In addition to bombing thousands of buildings and infrastructure, Israeli regime forces also killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children.
It was 7 p.m. on the last day of the holy month of Ramadan when the apartment building where I lived was bombed. Israeli warplanes first fired a drone rocket and minutes later hit the building with an F-16 bomb. My family is currently displaced and we are just lucky to be still alive. We call on all the world to help us rebuild our homes.
Over 2,200 Palestinians were also injured during the Israeli air raids, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation. Hundreds of Palestinian families have lost everything during Israel's May onslaught, and their plight has no end in sight.
My house was bombed on the morning of Eid al-Fitr around 5 a.m. It was a horrific scene beyond description. Can you imagine being with your wife and children preparing for the holiday, and all of a sudden your house is bombed and no longer have a place to call home?
Many Gazans had their lives shattered because of the recent war, and they still have no proper place to raise their families. Rights groups accused donor countries of failing to fulfill their financial pledges to rebuild the tiny coastal territory and end the illegal and inhumane Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Protesters have hit the streets of several Sudanese cities to denounce a recent deal between the military and Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok after last month's coup in the country. Protesters slammed Sunday's deal that reinstated Hamdok as a betrayal. They call it a cover-up for the military takeover of their country. Last month, the military dissolved the transitional government and detained cabinet members, including the Prime Minister, Abdullah Hamdok. Now, this happened despite the 2019 power-sharing deal with civilian leaders. Under the new deal, Hamdok has been allowed to lead a government of technocrats together with the military during a transition period. The two sides have also agreed to hold elections by July 2023, but pro-democracy activists are opposed to any deal with the military. Citing its deadly crackdown, of course, more than 40 protesters have been killed since the October 25 coup. Now, political commentator Edward Corrigan says the deal is a couple of steps forward, but is not something that the people wanted in Sudan following the coup.
Now the military has blinked. They're reinstating the government, reinstating the prime minister, releasing all political prisoners, and are supposedly still working under the context of the agreement to bring about the transition for democracy in a couple of years. So on one hand, it's a good deal. On the other hand, it still shows that the military is really pretty much in control. But I think that that's a reflection of the reality in Sudan. And the 15 groups that the that can mobilize and put people in the streets, that's not the same thing as confronting the army in a full-scale battle and overturning it. So it's a problem. I think on one hand, it's a couple steps forward, but on the other hand, the military is still very much in control. But I think that's the reality.
The COVID-19 pandemic rages on across Europe, with several countries reporting significant increases in their daily cases or deaths. In Britain, health officials reported more than 47,000 new cases. Government data shows that new infections in the country have risen nearly 10% compared to the previous week. This comes as the UK's total infections inches closer to 10 million. So far, the virus has claimed more than 144,000 lives in Britain. Meanwhile, in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel has warned about the serious situation in the country as COVID-related deaths have topped 100,000.
It is clear that the situation is still too serious, because we're still in a phase of exponential growth of infections, and the cases that are falling ill today will make up the intensive care patients in 10 or 14 days. That's why we must really be careful to ensure that our hospitals are not overwhelmed. That's a very important point, and every day counts.
Merkel also issued an urgent warning on pandemic management to the upcoming government, asking it to take quick, decisive measures. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy reported 71 coronavirus-related deaths and over 3,700 new infections. The country has the second highest death toll in Europe after Britain, with nearly 133,500 deaths from the novel coronavirus. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has called on France to agree to take back people who cross the English Channel to the UK. In a letter to the French President Emmanuel Macron, Johnson said taking back migrants would significantly reduce, if not stop, the crossings. British Prime Minister also proposed joint border patrols, aerial surveillance, and intelligence sharing with France. The letter comes after at least 27 migrants drowned in bitterly cold waters off the coast of France when their inflatable boat capsized on Wednesday. The migrants, so were heading towards Britain. France and Britain both blame each other for the tragedy.
Dozens more souls, including those of a pregnant woman and several children, lost to the sea. More lives lost in the dangerous quest to cross the English Channel. And even as the recovery efforts continue, the blame game intensified between the UK and France on how this tragedy unfolded and who should shoulder the blame.
I've offered to work with France to put more officers on the ground and do absolutely whatever is necessary to secure the area so that vulnerable people do not risk their lives by getting into unseaworthy boats.
The British Prime Minister was more forthright.
We've had difficulties persuading some of our partners, particularly the French, to do things in a way that we think is the situation deserves.
Et que toutes ces femmes et ces hommes ne veulent pas l'asile.
All these women and men do not want asylum in France. We offer them all. Those who want it are taken care of in the centres made available in Calais and Dunkirk, and we will strengthen the means of rescue at sea. But above all, we need to develop much stronger and more responsible partners.
This is yet another unsavoury chapter for Priti Patel's Home Office. And with the issue of migration, legal or otherwise, firmly linked to the Conservatives' law and order agenda, campaigners are urging the government to depoliticize this issue, seek cross-border solutions that may well save innocent lives.
Everything about how this government has approached the question of cross-channel refugees has been political point scoring and game playing with human lives and people escaping persecution, war and abuse, and subjecting them to criminalization and demonization.
For For many campaigners, the connection has to be made between the UK's foreign policy and the refugee crisis.
The truth is that the vast majority of refugees trying to get here are victims of war, and this is from a whole number of countries in which Britain has been centrally involved in these wars.
Boris Johnson has said no option is off the table.
As long as they keep treating this crisis as a crisis of invasion and criminality instead of a crisis of humanity and devastation across the world that is driving people to seek refuge, you are going to have more people die.
Tightening restrictions will mean more dangerous conditions for those hoping to get into Britain by any means necessary. This can only mean more lives lost in the days, weeks, and months to come. Amina Taylor, London.
Anti-government protests continue in Honiara, the capital of the Solomon Islands, for a third consecutive day, despite the arrival of Australian troops. Protesters torched buildings and looted shops. A large warehouse was also set alight, causing an explosion that sent scores of people fleeing in panic. Meanwhile, Australia is now deploying peacekeepers to help the government of the Pacific Islands overcome the current situation. Papua New Guinea has also sent a detachment of 34 peacekeepers after a request by Solomon's Prime Minister, Manasa Savary. The unrest began on Wednesday with protesters besieging Parliament and calling for the Premier's ouster. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
A new Minpress News study based on Department of Defense documents can reveal that U.S. weapons manufacturers have sold well in excess of $28.3 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began, including 20 separate deals inked during Biden's presidency. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Despite Pledge, Biden Leaves Top Open, Approving Billions in Arms Deals to Saudi Arabia. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. The biggest profiteer from Yemen's destruction has been aviation giant Boeing, which brought in $13.9 billion in sales over the period. Next comes Lockheed Martin, which has signed 62 separate contracts with the kingdom since March 2015, worth in excess of $7.4 billion. Third on the list is missile expert Raytheon, which has cashed in on the violence to the tune of $3.3 billion. Boeing's spot on the top of the pile comes in large part thanks to a massive $9.8 billion contract signed last year to maintain and modernize Saudi Arabia's fleet of 269 McDonnell Douglas F-15 Eagle fighter jets, including changing out hardware components, updating software, and improving weapon systems. 2020 was a great year for the company as it also secured a $1.97 billion fee to provide 650 SLAMER cruise missiles to the Saudi government. Lockheed Martin has scored big with the Saudi Navy, making billions of dollars, including a nearly $2 billion contract to build 4 warships. In addition, it secured enormous sales of Patriot missiles and laser and infrared technology. Black Hawk helicopters made by its subsidiary, Sikorsky, treated by the DoD as a separate entity, were also in high demand. Meanwhile, many of Raytheon's largest deals include air-to-ground missiles, guided bombs, and widespread logistical planning and technical support. The top 10 war profiteers supplying the Saudis with arms are as follows: Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Sikorsky, PKL Services, S&K Aerospace, DynCorp International, AITC 5 Domains, JVL3 Communications Core, and Kratos Technology and Training Solutions. Reading the approved sales, what becomes clear is the depth of U.S. involvement in virtually every aspect of the Saudi military. Of course, there are direct arms shipments, but there are also contracts for helmets and a wide range of equipment, intelligence services, maintenance arrangements, and even for English lessons for Saudi pilots to help them better use their aircraft features. While the offensive is widely known as the Saudi-led attack on Yemen, in reality, U.S.-made aircraft armed with American missiles and bullets maintained by American crews and flown by pilots trained by American operatives hit targets selected by U.S. intelligence. All of this is done under political and diplomatic protection by Washington, which blocks attempts by regional organizations to mitigate the destruction and shield Saudi Arabia from international consequences. This, in other words, is an American attack on Yemen. It is inconceivable that the Saudi-led coalition could be carrying out its attacks without the support of these companies. Kirsten Bayes of the Campaign Against Arms Trade, CAAT, told Mint Press via email, "Western-made weapons have been central to a bombardment that has destroyed schools, hospitals, homes, and created the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. It is long past time for arms shipments to the Saudi-led coalition to be brought to an end," it added. In total, 86 U.S. companies have profited from sales to Saudi Arabia since its intervention in Yemen, including household names like General Electric, Booz Allen Hamilton, and Honeywell. The full list is also available in the accompanying spreadsheet. Counting the value of the contracts is relatively straightforward. Counting the dead is not. One recent estimate, however, put the cumulative death toll from the conflict at over 560,000. If that is the case, American companies have made about $50,000 in sales per death. The Saudis have deliberately targeted Yemen infrastructure, including hospitals, farms, and sewage plants. Oxfam calculated that attacks on health and water facilities have taken place on average every 10 days since the conflict began. It is beyond doubt that American arms are in part of the blame for the carnage. In the first 2 years of fighting alone, pieces of Raytheon weapons were found at 12 different sites where civilians had been targeted. Meanwhile, fragments of Boeing Joint Direct Attack munition bombs were identified in the wreckage of a marketplace that had been targeted, killing 107 civilians, including 25 children. Not to be left out, 500-pound MK-82 bombs built and supplied by Lockheed Martin were used in an infamous 2018 attack on a school bus, killing 40 children, and a 2016 strike on a funeral hall that left 240 dead. The company's unexploded cluster munitions also littered the country, likely causing casualties for years or decades to come. The United States is the only major Western nation not to have signed the 2008 convention banning the production and use of cluster bombs. For for almost 7 years, Saudi forces have maintained a naval and aerial blockade of Yemen, cutting it off from the outside world. The closure of Sana'a Airport has been devastating for Yemen, driving up the prices of life-saving medicines and humanitarian aid and preventing mercy flights for tens of thousands of critically ill Yemenis who need emergency treatment abroad, Atayeb told Mint Press. Weapons manufacturers are well aware that their profits live and die on the decisions made by legislators. Lockheed Martin's latest annual report makes that explicit. In a section entitled Other Risks to Our Operations, the Bethesda, Maryland-based outfit noted, international sales also may be adversely affected by actions taken by the U.S. government in the exercise of foreign policy. Congressional oversight for financing of particular programs, including the prevention or imposition of conditions upon the sale and delivery of our products, the imposition of sanctions, or congressional action to block sales of our products. For example, they state the U.S. government has imposed certain sanctions on some entities and persons as described in the risk factor below and could act in the future to prevent or restrict sales to other customers, including the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Unsurprisingly, then, the military-industrial complex has lobbied the government hard to continue supporting the violence. Ronald L. Perilux, Jr., an executive with Lockheed Martin, denounced a wave of patently false hostile media reports about Saudi atrocities, described human rights laws as a significant irritant, and argued that the best thing to do is help the Saudis finish the job in Yemen by providing them with the benefit of our experiences, the training of their forces, and probably replenishment of their forces. His counterpart at Boeing, retired Air Force Lieutenant General Jeffrey Kohler, agreed, arguing that weapons transfers were actually a force for stability. When you sell somebody a big platform like an F-15, you build a 30-plus-year relationship with that Air Force, he said. If the public had their way, U.S. involvement would cease. A 2018 poll found that 82% of respondents wanted Congress to act to halt or decrease arms shipments to Saudi Arabia. American law already bans the sale of weapons to human rights abusing countries, but this legislation is constantly ignored. Conservative estimates suggest Washington is supplying military aid to almost three-quarters of the world's dictatorships. According to data from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, around three-quarters of all the Saudi military purchases come from American companies. Much of the rest comes from Great Britain. Riyadh's top 10 suppliers since 2015 are as follows, with percentage of total sales in parentheses. United States about 74%, United Kingdom 12%, France 4%, Canada 2%, Spain 2%, Germany 1%, Italy 1%, Switzerland 1%, and Turkey 1%. The British figure is dominated by BAE Systems, which has closed deals worth over $24 billion with Saudi Arabia since it began bombing Yemen, documents obtained by CAAT show. CAAT's base told Mint Press, BAE Systems UK-made Typhoon and Tornado aircraft have been central to Saudi Arabia's devastating attacks on Yemen. BAE Systems also has 6,300 employees in Saudi Arabia supporting the Saudi Air Force as part of the British-Saudi Defense Cooperation Program, and we know it sends weekly shipments by air to Saudi armed forces from its own private airport. Thus, while a figure between $28.3 billion and $63.1 billion is already monstrous, it tells only part of the story. The likes of Boeing, Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin were already supplying the Saudi government with weapons long before the conflict began. Boeing since 1945, Lockheed Martin since 1965, and Raytheon since 1966. American arms companies continue to supply other members of the Saudi-led coalition with similar arms. That number will continue to rise as deals negotiated with the Trump administration come to fruition. Therefore, the true extent to which the military-industrial complex is profiting off some of the most extreme suffering in the world is still not completely clear. All that is known is that the Saudis pay in petrodollars and the Yemenis pay in blood.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and how about listening to a gem of an advice from the model of magnanimity, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. When you gain power over your adversary, pardon him, by way of thanks for being able to overpower him.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, hated the people who were endowed with the following traits. He, peace be upon him, said, four traits lead to the quickest punishment. The person whom you treat with kindness, but he mistreats you. The person who you do not oppress, but oppresses you. The person to whom you are loyal, but he betrays you. The person who visits his relations, but they end their relationship with him.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has these beautiful conversations and these beautiful dialogues with his friends, his companions, his relatives, his family members, and, you know, the people in general. And so Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he has this very beautiful way of putting forth wisdom in a very concise, precise, accurate, short, and beautiful manner. What is interesting is that this quality is not limited to just Imam al-Baqir, but all of the divinely appointed infallible imams had this quality within them, and of course, the master of us all, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, also had this quality. So in one of these conversations, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is asked about who are the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. He is asked what is an attribute of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Holy Prophet Muhammad and the infallible imams. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he replies that our followers are those who obey Allah. Unbelievable. And we say, Allahu Akbar. God is great. Allah is great. This sentence of maybe four or five words in reply to this question about the attributes and who are the followers of the Holy Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, our followers are those who obey Allah. So, dear friends, if we consider ourselves to be the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, if we consider ourselves to be the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, if we consider ourselves to be the supporters and the friends of the Ahlul Bayt, then we must obey Allah. And obeying Allah comes in two manners, in two forms, in two faces. One is to do all those things which Allah has made wajib, obligatory upon us. And the second is to refrain from anything and everything that Allah has made haram for us, forbidden for us. So, if you want to be a follower of the Holy Prophet and of the Ahlul Bayt, remember to obey Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. Unfortunately, we live at a bad time. That's the problem at the time of Imam al-Baqir, Imam Zain al-Abidin. People that had good attire, looked religious, had contact with a few of the tabi'een, they said the Prophet said this, everybody trusted that. Imam Zain al-Abidin, Imam al-Baqir, most of all. That's not how this works. We have to do that. And then lastly, but most importantly, and we keep saying this, and we will continue to keep saying this, because it is a must. The reason why Imam al-Baqir kept saying this in so many different ways. Brothers and sisters, the Qur'an is available to us. The Qur'an is available to us. Wallah, the Qur'an is available to us. The Qur'an is the word of God. No word in it has changed. No sentence in it has changed. We have access to this book today, and anything we hear of Islam can be referred back to the Quran, should be referred back to the Quran. And seen, does it match it? Does it not match it? The Imam did not tell scholars only. This was for a lot of different people. The Quran says this. The Quran didn't come for ulama. The Quran came for everyone. The Qur'an is available for everyone. God in it. Let's listen to what he says. He says, Hudan linnas, not Hudan lil ulama. It's guidance for all people. And it says, it's bayinat. It's got clarity in it. The pillars of clarity, and then what, based on those pillars, can be understood. There's muhkam and mutashabih. The Qur'an itself says not everything has that level of clarity. On the subject, it's still clear. But to understand that, you need to understand something else, which is called muhkam in the Qur'an. But if you constantly refer to the Qur'an, if we are regularly in touch with the Qur'an, if we regularly read the Qur'an with understanding, try to reflect and understand it, and when we understand something, implement it. If we do that, wallah, the book will speak to you. This is not my words. The Quran says it. Imam al-Baqir says it. The living Quran says it.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Manuscripts are precious and can sometimes fetch attractive sums of money, but this one has gone far beyond, as it's a really rare handwriting belonging to a world-famous scientist. This manuscript was sold for a whopping $13 million at an auction at Christie's in Paris, but would you still be surprised if we told you that it belongs to no one but the great physicist of our time, Albert Einstein? Einstein did not have a habit of keeping drafts, and this is one of only two manuscripts that have survived. Einstein wrote the 54-page document in the early 1900s in Zurich, Switzerland, and his colleague Michel Besseau has preserved it since then. The document contains Einstein's preparatory work for his signature achievement, the theory of general relativity. Einstein's letters have set records twice before, but for much lower prices. November is the best time of the year to see polar bears moving around Canadian shores. During this month, the carnivores gather in large numbers and wait for the waters to freeze before they begin their seal hunt. These bears are playing and wrestling in the Canadian city of Churchill, dubbed the polar bear capital of the world. The area is located within a natural habitat of a large population of polar bears. Sometimes the city's residents even share the streets with these animals. Currently, there are nearly 25,000 polar bears in the wild, and Canada is home to more than 17,000 of them. However, wildlife organizations say these animals are facing the threat of extinction by the end of the century due to global warming. Robots in a war ravaged city. Androids serve clients in a restaurant in Mosul, an Iraqi city that still bears the scars of the years-long presence of terrorist groups. This fully digital eatery offers a futuristic experience to its customers. From interactive tables to glowing constellations, everything seems like a journey to the future. But the robot waiters are the stars of the show, and the major reason the restaurant attracts a large number of visitors every night.
The idea started during the COVID lockdown. As you know, people spent most of their time on social media during that period, since commuting was not allowed. So we tried to look at different ideas from around the world, and thank God we were able to execute this idea and complete this project.
The owner of the eatery says he has imported the robots, but other technologies used there are the work of a group of young engineers from the University of Mosul. The venue has already become very popular, and many visitors call it their favorite place in the city. Qatar displays a dazzling drone show as it unveils the countdown clock for the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Doha. The clock, in the shape of an hourglass, is located at Doha's iconic Corniche fishing spot. The distinctive design enables the structure to be seen from any angle and stand out from the spectacular city skyline behind it. The event reveals to fans worldwide that just 1 year to go to the big kickoff,
famous athletes including David Beckham and Samuel Eto'o were in attendance at the ceremony. They may not realize it, but they are extremely lucky. Two pandas have been adopted by superstars. Chinese Olympic champion Zhang Jiechi and Paris Saint-Germain footballer Kylian Mbappe have become godparents to a pair of panda cubs. The athletes have both expressed satisfaction with their new role, with Mbappe calling his godparenthood a big moment. The cute cubs are only 3 months old and can barely stand on their own feet. They are called Yuan Dudu and Huan Lili. Space lovers have been treated to an epic lunar eclipse that dazzled the night skies of the Northern Hemisphere. The event is also known as the Blood Moon because of the red haze seen around the moon during the eclipse. The 3.5-hour phenomenon gave stargazers the chance to witness the longest partial eclipse in 580 years. Although NASA calls this celestial event a partial eclipse, around 97% of the moon was cast into a red hue by the Earth's shadow. A total eclipse could also be seen in Russia's far eastern regions. The next longest partial eclipse will take place in around 648 years.
An 11-month-old baby has become an internet sensation after a video of her snowboarding went viral in China. Wang Yuji is a daredevil infant snowboarder whose adorable face sticks out underneath all the protective snow and sports gear. Her parents decided to learn skiing during the winter, but they also wanted to include their baby on the fun of snow sports. Snowboarding might be a bit too early for a toddler who can barely stand or walk. Yuji was not scared at all and even enjoyed it. China, which is hosting the Winter Olympics in a couple of months, is encouraging citizens to try ice and snow sports.
Every year, the roads across this tiny island in northwestern Australia turn scarlet just as millions of crabs leave their homes in the depths of the forest and start marching together all the way to the ocean where they can mate and spawn. The spectacular group voyage on Christmas Island happens after the first rainfall in October or November. And in order to give these red creatures the leeway, locals close off multiple roads across the island. They've even built a special bridge for the crabs so that it can cross the road unharmed. The mesmerizing migration is now a tourist attraction, drawing nature lovers from around the globe.
Paleontologists in Brazil have discovered remains that could belong to a species of dinosaur as yet unknown. The fossils were found at a site in northeastern Brazil. A team of scientists is trying to put together the bones and complete the huge dinosaur's skeleton. They think it lived during the Cretaceous period, which began around 145 million years ago and ended with extinction of all dinosaurs roughly 66 million years ago.
A new study shows that moderate consumption of tea and coffee may be better for your health than previously thought. The study conducted by a Chinese medical university says tea and coffee can help keep stroke and dementia at bay. And if you're wondering what is meant by moderate consumption, it's defined as something between 2 and 5 cups of tea and coffee, either alone or combined in one day. The study followed more than 360,000 people aged 50 to 74 for over a decade. Some scientists have praised the study as robust, Others, however, say the participants were all selected from the UK Biobank, which means they're healthier than the general population.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Pomegranate has a special place in Iranian culture. There is a trace of the fruit everywhere from poetry to cooking. Iranians even hold a pomegranate festival in the fall. This year the event is held in one of the main parks in the capital, Tehran. The festival features different varieties of pomegranates that are grown across Iran. The visitors can also find pomegranate products, including juices, concentrates, and dressings. The event includes cultural parades, music concerts, and traditional live performances. Iranians say they always welcome the pomegranate season, as it's one of the old symbols in the country's literature and art. Christmas season always brings happiness and joy to people around the world. Many Parisians these days are taking a respite from their daily routines and hitting famous departmental stores now light up with present boxes. Cheerful families could be spotted at Christmas-decorated galleries, Lafayette and Printemps department stores. Automated figures and colorful window displays are the center of attractions for them and their children. It's a season when people buy Christmas gifts for their loved ones and stores make big profits this time around. Many Parisians say they want to take advantage of this period as the government is debating whether or not to impose a COVID-related lockdown. In Venezuela, a large number of musicians are striving for one common goal, and that's setting the Guinness record as the world's largest orchestra. Over 12,000 musicians, mostly children and adolescents, have played together to make that happen. Of violins, violas, and double basses playing in unison at this setting in Caracas. The musicians are all connected to the country's network of youth orchestras. For them to set a record, over 8,000 instruments had to play at the same time during a 5-minute period of a classical piece. Right now, a Russian orchestra that played the country's national anthem is holding the record. Once done, the crowd of musicians erupted in cheers, lifting their instruments and waving Venezuelan flags. Guinness will announce its decision in the next 10 days. Tourists and residents in Los Angeles have been mesmerized by a dazzling new event the U.S. city is hosting with holiday-themed and a full of colorful lights. Visitors can enjoy a mile-long walkway covered on all sides with brightly lit installations. Artists from around the world have taken part in the exhibition. The centerpiece display is a cathedral tunnel lit with thousands of bulbs. Another amazing attraction is the orbs lit up with thousands of torches. The event has been a huge hit with the LA public.
Oh my gosh, it's so nice.
And it gets to be out in the open, and it's like a perfect night to do it, so it's great.
It's definitely the best. Like, we had to do, like, in a car to go see lights, and then we got to, like, now, like, go around and actually walk and get to see everything up close, which is super nice.
Yeah.
Definitely after the, year and a half that we've had.